after he had fully syrensified his thirst with hard liquor. One night he had a little bit too much, and he leaned over to swipe the skimmings from the syrup, and the alcoholic content in syrup is not questionable, but he thought that there was a little bit more in there, and he sort of could increase the agony or the joy, as the case might be. He slipped and fell into the barrel, and as he climbed out of the barrel, he looked at himself all covered with syrup. And he's standing there in the basement, you know, dripping, and tears start to form in his eyes, and he looked at himself, and he says, "Lord, make my tongue equal to the task." Now if it were not for the peculiar and the beautiful style of the Eucharist this evening, I think that I would be quite tongue-tied, quite unable, if you will, to deal with what we've got to deal with tonight. But the Eucharist has sort of said, man, you know, you don't say and abide by the old ideas that there are certain things you just don't do after the Eucharist, you know. There are certain things that you don't talk about. There are certain ways in which you don't express yourself. Do it any other time, but not after the Eucharist. Particularly interested in the style, if you will, of the service, which was not a departure from the service that I've been getting all of the days that and my family and others have been getting since they've been at the village. I want to start, however, with something that I feel that I have to start with, and that is not a criticism of the Eucharist, but something that I observed. I wasn't looking for it, but I observed it basically because it sort of distracted me. And surprisingly enough, it was bothering me something terrible when Marty called my name. And I didn't hear it the first time. Apparently he had called it before, but then I heard him say, "Where's Will?" And well, here I am here, you know. I don't know whether he was saying come back to what I was talking about or what at this point, you know. We're going to have to discuss this, but I just want to bare my soul at this point. Little children wondering about the Coke cups, whether or not there was coffee or Kool-Aid in them, or maybe wine, and wondering why they were denied the Coke cups. And there were a couple of little tykes who almost got violent. They were almost violent when the cups went by them. And they were even more violent, I guess, when the bread went by them. However, I didn't see that until I started to listen when the cups came. Now, that was a pretty sad moment for me, because while it was like the village food place, and I was celebrating that fact, yet there was something so special about that moment that little children were denied. I had to say that because when Charles Morgan, who is a leading Anglican lay theologian, was chased out of Birmingham, Alabama for having presented his beliefs openly, a reporter stuck a microphone in his face and said, "Mr. Morgan, have you got any final words for the good people of Birmingham?" And Mr. Morgan said, "Yeah, get that damn thing closer so that I can tell you what I'm thinking." How vicious. How vicious. How
vicious the silence of the general people. I think that's a topic in itself, and I think that Reverend Father Marty sort of displayed, in spite of some of the opinions that might be broached, that he was not omniscient at that moment, or I'm sure he would have dealt with it, and he would have dealt with it in his own inimitable style. And maybe he will later on in the discussion. We shall see. And somehow he would have found that it might have taken a few more minutes, but there were some housewives in the congregation who needed to be reminded about something other than fabric and how you keep it from tearing and stuff. And if there were winemakers there, and I know that there were a few, that's an inside joke now. Somebody want to make it an outside one, all right. There was something that they should be reminded of other than winemaking. But then something that he says, I think, sort of capsules my moment of frustration, but at the same time, my moment of celebration, because some of you know now how I stand on celebrating the ambiguity of change and etc. And I won't go through the whole rhetoric again. I went through that earlier in the week, and how dangerous the new is. But that doesn't make you afraid of it. It makes you celebrate. So thank you, as I said to some of the staff already, and to Brother Marty. Now, I want you to remember that part, because I think that we've got to deal with the viciousness of the silence of general people. We've got to deal with some of the obvious misunderstandings at this point. But there are a few other things that I want to do here, and I'm going to try and make them concrete if I can. By way of illustration, there's nothing wrong with a traffic law which says you have to stop for a red light. I agree with that, and I think that more lives would be saved if there were more people in this country who did agree with that. But when a fire is raging, and I underline the word raging, the fire truck goes right through the red light. And if there is anybody in its way, they had better move, because the fire truck must of necessity deal with, thanks, Bill, the raging fire. Same difference if you want something that's a little more human with the ambulance. Normal traffic must stop. And it must stand still when someone is bleeding to death. A couple of black psychoanalysts have written a book called Black Rage, and while they did not use these examples, the entire text is replete, at least for me, with that kind of example. This rage is to be contrasted up to a point between Brother Martin and between the more recent exponents of the Black Power lifestyle. The two are not contradictory. That's one other thought. violence as it has been presented in public press sort of gets its its hand slapped with the Kerner report or the Algiers motel incident or the Chicago Democratic Convention, and we have to talk about that. And here we're going to depend again on Marty, who was there, to sort of interpret whether I am correct or not when I say that the man at this hour has shown to us that he is in desperate need of a nigger, and that he has elected to be his nigger, his children. They are called young white niggers. That's another thought. Some of you must have some thoughts on property rights versus human rights. And it's possible that some of us have started to wrestle with whether both at this hour in history can remain sacrosanct. And then another thought. Being overprotective is also quite violent. My kids come from the city, and the city allegedly is the most dangerous place in the world, at least in this country. But yet they've got more bruises and more scratches and more bee stings and things, slivers under fingernails and stuff. Trust, and I was just talking about this before I came down to Vespers, than they've ever had in their lives. and we were kind of wondering how dangerous the city is. and then we said, well, my God, you know, let's cut this out. This is our conversation this afternoon yet, you know. We'd better check out whether or not we might not have been a little overly protective of our kids, because we too thought that the city was dangerous, and we thought that Holden was safe. it's the Lord, you know, trying to, I think, because he created bees too, have kind of convinced us that we can be violent in our overprotecting of each other. It's called, in the black camp, plantation charity or paternalism, and how violent that is. Well, I gotta say that great minds run in the same circle, and now I'll have to have your brother's name. Where is he?
Brother?
Yeah.
Mark, right here.
Oh, no, there he is, Mark. He gives me a little thing here, and I want you to listen to this, and then I'm gonna shut up. We were coming down to Vespers, and he says, "Hey, I want you to look at this. This is it. This is in the New Republic, in case any of you are wondering." And I got it was sent to the Harvard Divinity Hall, Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's just that I want you to know that the New Republic is in the Harvard thing. How Mark got it, I don't know. But let's listen to the paragraph. Schopenhauer wrote a tale describing a scene in which a group of porcupines came together in an open field one cold night, attempting to keep each other warm and to survive. They picked each other when they huddled close. I'm sorry, they pricked each other when they huddled close, and some left the group in order to avoid personal injury. The next morning, they were found frozen. They had died alone. The others suffered, but helped each other survive. Well, he goes on to talk about the similar scene being played out in Maryland and stuff. That's not important for our discussion right now, but I thought that you'd like to hear that one, because that was it was not a new thought, but something that sort of confirmed and I think put into some rather picturesque and moving style, the other thing that I think we ought to be thinking about. Well, now, This is done, as I said before, because there are some of you who felt that we had to talk about this before you left this week. So there it is. Well, I just did that, Mark. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. But I'm not going to do it now because I think that does it better. Some of us still have this thing about, being. We give in, when something communicates better, and I'm thankful for that. It's all yours now, folks.
I'd like to ask you a question. Well, how can you stay with a church, with a Lutheran church?
There seems to be some question as to whether or not I'm with a Lutheran church. I am with the church. And quite frankly, I haven't found anything better. Which is not to say that. Oh, okay, all right. Well, I'll leave it there and let you read between lines.
Maybe I should be more explicit. How do you stay? How do you deal with the ambiguity of living with the oppressor and being a part of the organization structure of the oppressor?
I don't live with the oppressor. You see, it would have been, I think, very fitting had I put on a pith helmet and some white clothes, white shirt and white short pants, and got myself a swivel stick, and walked around with boys carrying my bags, and because I come into the village as a missionary. missionaries, have had a rather strange and peculiar habit of not living with the folks that they're allegedly living with. Don't be self-conscious about the silence, folks. It's communicating something to me, so I'm not concerned about the silence. Give people time, all right?
Julie, I asked a question the other night in the meeting on the Christian lifestyle, which meant that we couldn't put our finger on what a Christian lifestyle was. And one of the questions I asked of you, I said it sort of depends on who sets the standard of what the lifestyle is. And I indicated that you, because your bag was what it is, and great concerns and evil cause and poverty and so on, might be that everybody should live like Christ and divest themselves of the current wealth that was cumulatively existed in the this room to the point of reducing oneself to poverty, the process of giving to the black brothers or to the poor white or what have you. And you just made a few comments now about that property and personal rights are not sacrosanct and might be a candidate for change. If you want to maybe tie the comment the other night and your very brief statement on property rights and personal rights are not sacrosanct and may have to change for you. Mm-hmm. On that?
I'd love to. I'd like to reserve my opinion, though, to get opinions from the group. I mean, it's a simple situation here of do you agree or do you disagree. I think that my points, are quite clear at this point, and I agree with what I said.
I have a question. In Dallas, I am in a manufacturing business. I hire about 500 people. I pay approximately $1.25 per hour more than the union calls for. I have a 30% labor turnover per month. I have a permanent ad that runs 365 days a year in the Dallas News and the Dallas Times Herald. I have excellent working conditions. I have a 30% labor turnover per month. If the people won't work for it, white, black, or green with purple polka dots, why should we give it to them? Do I get any response from anybody?
All right. Somebody want to respond to that?
What is the nature of the work? Do they have to be...
This is manufacturing. It's everything from working in a boiler shop, which is miserable, dirty, nasty work, to working in air-conditioned shops where electrical panels are put together. It's all manufacturing of equipment, water heaters, water softeners, car washes, crating, shipping, receiving, parts. It's a complete manufacturing plant. Most people have been in some kind of a manufacturing plant. I can take you to 15 plants in Dallas that have permanent signs on the walls and on the fences. Dr. Pepper, Coca-Cola, Lane Temco Vought, Chance Vought, all of them. Permanent signs, help wanted mail. I can also take you to places in Dallas where people live, that right today, it had probably hadn't rained in a month, you got to walk across a plank to get across the floor because of the water and the roaches and those kind of conditions. Now those people want us to give things to them, and yet they won't give me their labor so that I can afford to give them more. Now how can we instill people to want to work and earn things? Christ worked. Christ was a carpenter. He worked with his hands and he worked hard. He only preached for 3 years. The rest of the time he labored. He had long hair, sure, but he also had muscles and he had calluses.
Okay, somebody get hurt up there?
careful about that railing, Don.
Now, I take it, sir, that there are several groups. They are not the polka dots and others that you've addressed yourself to at this point. Now, if I'm reading something into what you're asking, let me just see if I can lay it out so that maybe we can start
to come in and you can talk to each other.
Yeah.
I'm just the last 10 minutes.
I don't like being in front of everybody. But
that's all right. We just did it there.
Now, I take it that you're describing a number of groups here. One group would be a group with long hair. Let me see if I can get the groups out, and then you can, you know, eliminate the ones that you've not been dealing with, you know, with your statements. The other are black, I think. And there are some who may not have long hair and who may also be white. I think that there are some red people and some yellow people and some brown people that you've also described, knowing Dallas. Having lived on Lover's Lane for about 3 weeks once, in a little hotel near Lover's Lane. I used to make a walk up there before they started to urban renew that Lover's Lane section around our Zion Church. But the group that you've described, I think, you know, may be represented here. I'm going to just deal, if I can, in one or two sentences with black people, okay? for a number of years in this country, every black man had a job. No black man was unemployed. He worked from what black people call kin to kink. You know, from the time that he could see to the time that he couldn't, for nothing. Now, I don't want to get too much into history. That's Marty's bag again. But Marty, before you came in, I described our various bags and that they were all cellophane, you know, so we can leave them completely open. I think, you know, Plessy versus Ferguson, you know, all this, the Reconstruction it was called. But, you know, there was a little thing in there, you know, where every black person was promised 40 acres and a mule. Somebody undoubtedly, you know, had been stricken with a certain fit of intellectuality or greed, you know, I don't know which one it was, and they said, you know, these people have earned 40 acres and a mule. So some of us, you know, have been playing around with, you know, how we collect this debt, and how we somehow articulate to American white folk that they've got an inescapable date with the destiny to pay that debt. So we figure out how much 40 acres cost these days, and we convert mules into horses and horses into horsepower, and horsepower into, you know, what you got in this society today, and we come up with a fantastic figure. And as one brother said, I'll be damned if I'm going to work, you know, and have 50 million more of my people die in order to collect that debt. I got to have help collecting that debt. And I cannot have help from people who say, you ought to work for it, without realizing that we in fact have. Now, if, you know, if the old inheritance thing is true, you know, like, you know, if the papa has a piece of ground and he passes it on to his children, you know. Now black folks passed, my foreparents passed on that ground for which they worked to me. That's my turf.
I didn't give it to you. My great-grandmother was a full-blooded Cherokee Indian, and we didn't give it to nobody. So it wasn't theirs to give to you, was it?
Well, now, I have stated the case of black people at this point. Yes, it is.
No, it wasn't. The white people took it away from the Indians, and you got to deal with the Indians on that 40 acres.
Some of you know that I've been trying to get this village back for the Indians ever since I've been here. Have I or haven't I?
Listen, I will tell you people a story. My mother was born in Texas. My father was born in Louisiana. My father was in the service, and we moved to the Philippines when I was about 2 years old. And we stayed there till I was about 16, just before the war broke out, and I came back to the United States. My best friend was a fellow by the name of Tom Dixie. Tom Dixie's daddy was probably the blackest man I've ever known, but probably the whitest man I ever knew. And Tom, as I say, was my favorite friend. I happened to be the one there who was constantly being segregated. There was an English boy, a German boy, and myself. We were the only three white kids in school. Everybody else was either brown or black or yellow. And Tom Dixie was the only one that ever fought for me. And I'll fight the colored man's battles, and I have in the South. I have alienated friends and ruined dinner parties and everything else, taking up for the black man. But I want to know why the black man can't help me take up for him. Why can't he get out? I work hard. I put in long hours, and I'm sure everybody here does too. And like I say, my parents really did own this country, at least on my mother's side. It was taken away from them.
You and my wife, incidentally, are relatives then.
That's right.
Because she's half Cherokee.
Well,
you see.
But you see, I take it all the way a little further back, you and I are related too.
But the point is that she is not in control of the work labor force that you are. Why are you and not her?
You know why?
Because
she did lots and lots of hours. That's right.
And why else?
Why doesn't God make everybody blind? Just think of that. And we couldn't tell with our man's nose as though it
was a good idea.
Why don't you join the circle?
You can't. We're arguing eggs and eggplants. I'm with you, but I want a little help. Do you know how in the South, and from way back from Amos and Andy's time, they have pictured the colored man?
I'm aware of that.
All right. I can take you to places in Dallas where white people are that make the most lazy colored man you ever saw look like the most industrious fellow you ever saw.
Uh-huh. There's that uh-huh.
And there are lots of white people, and they don't have what I've got.
See, my problem is that I understand exactly what you're saying. I don't particularly enjoy the Beverly Hillbillies, some of the young people with whom we had this discussion yesterday. I can't do that basically because I think I understand what's being done to them. Johnny Cash, he's got to pay a fantastic sum for burning down a forest here in this country, the western section of the country too. But I can't understand that.
Why not?
Because Johnny Cash is Johnny Cash, you know.
It wasn't because of Johnny Cash, because he went out there and started a fire.
No, he didn't start a fire. General Motors probably should pay for that, you know.
That
yes. They've been recalling those cars, you know, to have the mufflers fixed. Not because they might start forest fires, at least I got one of those cards. Not because they would start forest fires, but because it was possible, you know, that somebody could get asphyxiated, right? Now, this is my question is that, you know, Johnny Cash is going to pay it. He's not arguing with it, but it was a muffler.
I got that on both the General Motors Bar Courthouse now. Johnny Cash took that car where he wasn't supposed to.
I can do the same thing, though. I went in to pay a traffic fine.
Well,
there was a colored fellow in front of me with 8 tickets, and the judge wrote them off, and he wouldn't write mine off. And it was a white judge.
Smart judge.
That's right. But I didn't think so.
You were second in line, Willie.
But what I'm trying to say is that I understand all of this because I understand oppression, you know? But you see, I get terribly suspicious of someone who would trot out those examples because I somehow suspect that lurking in the back of their minds there's something, how am I going to get out of this? I need help, but how am I going to avoid getting help? And so I trot out examples, you know, and every time a black man presents himself for what's rightfully his, then somebody says, what about the Indian? And what about the Appalachian whites? What about other folks? Don't you folks have it better in this country than you had it in Africa? You know, these are the questions that are asked. Those are not the questions that ought to be asked of me. So I sort of run up against a wall here at this point and say, yes, I understand, but I am not going to presume to speak for, as I tried to do and got into trouble, as you see, Johnny Cash or the Beverly Hillbillies. Or any of those people who are not around to tell it like it is themselves, you see. Now, I must tell it as it is. I must articulate, using the traditional rhetoric of white folk, if you will, what it is, how it is with black people. And so I do that. And while I don't want to narrow the discussion, some other folks may want to respond in the other areas. But here again, you know, my portfolio does not, you know, presume to speak for my brothers and sisters in any. Now, see, if this were, you know, a totally theological discussion, and I think it is, but you see, we're here doing for instance stuff, and I think that the for instance stuff then. Means that I become quite limited, you know, to come up with and to develop rationale for all of the for instances here. Yeah. Just chime in.
Several times, you referred to the debt being owed to the black man. When you say this, are you speaking for yourself only, or are you speaking for black people in America?
I'm speaking for black people in America.
Saying that this is the way a substantial number of them feel today?
Yes. I'm saying that this is the way all black people feel today.
Isn't that presumptuous to talk so boldly for all?
For all black people, it is not presumptuous.
Can I change? Well, then you thought of this, carry a little further. You must have thought further down the road. If we gave them this sum of money,
Let me speak for, because I think it speaks to both. I remember 2 years ago a guy named Griffin who spoke on campus. He wrote Black and Key, and he spent about 2 or 3 hours telling us, you know, how he went through the process of becoming a black man for a while. And after 3 hours, he instilled in me a feeling at least being able to empathize for in a small way of what it must feel to be discriminated against, and how, like he said, you know, after a while he just sat down and looked, you know, watched people, and he didn't even want to get up. And you know, I can see this idea where the black man has been put down so bad in many instances that he doesn't even want to get up. And I really have a great admiration for those who have made it in spite of all the difficulties and all the crap they've had to take in order to become a lawyer or a doctor or someone who is the head of a business organization. And it seems to me here, Willie's talking about the debt to black people. Well, maybe we can't give them 40 acres and a mule, you know, or $40,000. To me, in a lot of ways, that's unrealistic. But maybe we can, like someone who is a manufacturer, someone who has, you know, ability to do this, develop programs where people who think they, you know, have no estimation of value or worth of themselves can be brought in, you know, and someone say, hey, you are worth something, you are trainable, you can make a decent living. And the thing, though, it's you can't say, I remember my mom telling me that, you know, about all the ads run in the paper about needing typists and stenographers, well-trained and all this, and no response from black people. And I said, I didn't have any answer for it at first. And then finally, I began to realize why black people didn't show up. It's because they just had no feeling that they could even accomplish that.
Well, let's just go that one further. You know, just so to show you how you understand the black condition. It is not that black people cannot read. But when we say that you need money to buy a job, we mean also that you got to have money with which to afford the morning newspaper to read about the ad.
Now you're far divorced from the world of business if you believe that.
What?
I say you are far divorced from the world of business if you believe that you have got to have a dime for a morning paper to find a job.
I think I can address myself as part of the problem. In Detroit, they gave themselves a goal, seemed kind of unrealistic for a while, of providing jobs for poverty level, all colors, any color. They went into the ghetto, set up their hiring halls so that people didn't have to buy newspapers, for instance. Went into the street, literally, recruited these people. 2,500 to 3,000 in a short period of weeks. Their turnover was as great as yours, greater. They found out these people had lived in the city for 30 years and didn't know how to transfer from one bus to another. Didn't know how to find out which buses to transfer to get to work. They didn't have, they had lockbox, but no conception of how long it would take. They're showing up at work 2 hours early. They found out that was wrong, so they took the next bus and missed that bus and got to work late. Instead of going late, getting them to show up late, so it didn't show up at all. The next thing they did is got kind of big brothers for these people. And they gave them, found out which buses to take, got them in carpools, told them ahead of time what kind of clothes they'd need. These people hadn't been exposed to this culture, the factory culture, the foundry culture, hadn't been exposed to. They found out that just these little helps, these people wouldn't show up at an employment office just because they didn't want to be exposed to these problems.
Right,
they could avoid these problems by not showing up at an employment office. They've placed 10,000 of these compounds. The only thing they need for a solution is to train them in things we take for granted in a few weeks.
I'd like to ask the gentleman from Texas a question. If I were to come to your place, that, you know, it sounds to me like as a preacher I could make more money.
You'd have better working conditions, wouldn't you?
I just kidding. I'm overpaid. If I came to your place to get a job, what process would I go through?
Well, the first thing I'm more interested in is whether you have collected and how often and how long you have collected workman's compensation and for what purpose. Because despite what this man says about training these people and teaching them how to set an alarm clock and so forth, they will, most of them, I don't mean black, I have better than a 50-50 ratio, and I have a 30% labor turnover per month. Now you multiply that out into training time.
I want to know what process I get through to get into the problem at your place.
All right, I could probably put you to work within 2 hours after you show up.
What do I have to do before the 2 hours is up?
Fill out an application and be interviewed by the personnel manager.
You put the guy in a school first, and he doesn't even learn how to read and write, and then you give him an application blank, and you say, the dummy can't write, you know, we'll hire another guy. Now, I don't say you do that, but I'm going to say that I am sure that there are hundreds of thousands, and I'm not exaggerating, in the years that I've lived in Detroit, that there have been hundreds of thousands of guys that never moved into where the great big signs are up, help wanted, because they knew they couldn't pass the test that was designed to keep them up.
The test consists of writing your name, your address, and your social security number.
Well, I'm addressing myself to your question about why a black man, not in your place, but why a black man in general cannot advance. And maybe I could dramatize it by asking this question: how many people in this room try to dramatize the answer to your question? I don't think we all had a lot to answer that here. How many of us in this room think that any one of the three Lutheran synods that we're from could have a Negro president?
By the way, Missouri Senate is running Mrs. Hertzfeld. Pretty funny for me to take 15 seconds to state the credentials. First of all, this is 4 years minus 2 months. We got time. First of all, for publicity content, we need a lifetime Newsweek coverage. Secondly, we solve both these men's problems. We're part Indian, we get to know the black, we just finally, after 122 years, gave the women the vote, so they can all vote 51%. So that's it. And with a German Jewish name, the liberals feel guilty about the Jews, and they're going for that. The Germans, who are the majority, will go for the German sound of it. Blacks are making their point to us. The beauty is there, but we do have... There still are a few people in our Senate who do have prejudice against the Indians.
Well, I'd like to propose an answer to the question that you raised. We're back on the cliche that I've heard and learned and used since I was probably 6-7 years old. Term called nigger rich. A lot of you heard this term. Okay, what it means, you've got off.
Run it down, Tim.
And it's going to take you 4 or 5 days to spend it. And I'm going to spend it. What has happened here, we notice everyone in many other areas, is that when somebody comes off of subsistence, or he's been living on less than 2,000 calories a day, and these calories consumed are primarily sow belly, a few peas, beans, rice, something like this. A person can live on, not him, but they learn to live on $2 or $3 a day, or maybe $1 a day. All of a sudden, when the paycheck comes by for a month or 2 months or 3 months, this is 2 or 3 years income. And he is flush, and he can get along on easy street, and he will go up to spend the money. Let's take the route south, 1,800 miles or so from Dallas, and go to the Mexico City area, where again we're in a poverty situation. The salary for a common labor is 5 pesos a day. With this man raises a family. When a contractor comes in to build a plant, and this man, instead of getting 5 pesos a day, is getting 10 pesos a day, you know what he does? 9 times out of 10, he gets another wife, he starts another family. And you have got this same element in this rapid turnover in the low, in the jobs that are easy to come in. It doesn't take too long to pick up the skill, but most manufacturing operations are set for the stability of the organization that training programs are held relatively low.
Sort of interesting.
You're attracting people in, and this is where people will come in, and It's just like skipping a rock across water. It may take 5, 6, 7, or 8 times.
Sort of interesting.
Until they learn how to set the alarm clock, until they learn, well, now I've got it, now I'm going to have ham once a week. Well, now the ham once a week, I've got to work another 4 hours next week. There's a lot of this in this high turnover. We find it in foreign construction. The organization I work with, we build plants all over the world. And we move into a foreign country, and we will train the local natives in the building of the plants. The construction trade is required.
I remember once going into the Mississippi Delta with a Lutheran World Relief person. And we stopped at a general store in the Delta. And apparently this black gentleman had made 50 cents more that day than he would have made ordinarily. So he goes into the general store and he buys a big stalk of bananas, something like 25 or 30 of them. And he sits down on the porch of the general store and he just stuffs himself with those bananas, you know. And so the people who were down there to help them, you know, said, you know, I don't think that these people need help. They need an education. They need lessons in economics and stuff like this, you know, how not to buy bananas, but how to buy bologna or sow belly or something that's got, you know, a little more protein than bananas. One of the black fellows with us, you know, said, "You're right. That's what you call extravagance, waste, you know, and general fouling up of how you use money." He said, that's the basic bane of the existence of folks in this country. Sort of interesting how Chicano people invest in people while we invest in things. This man gets himself more people around him, more wives, more children, and things like this. However, we elect more boats and more houses and bigger factories and more property, isn't it?
Isn't it a matter also of not having ever kept the faith? And you can take this literally and actually. Just take the last three administrations, and this includes the current one. How many times have big grand plans been, you know, passed through a legislative body, and then there's no appropriation to carry them out? How many times has faith really been broken with the oppressed, with the black in particular? So that when you keep breaking the promise that you hold out like bait, and then you undercut it, you know, so what good is your word to me? It's really the psychology of the whole third world that we're dealing with. It's just like in your family. If you promise your child that you're going to do something, but you've got a million reasons of why you never carry it to fruition, is he really going to believe you even though you've got a sign plastered all over the sky?
That's right. You sort of lead me, I think, into what I want to lead us away from. If the black brothers could see me now, they would say, "Hertzfeld, you know, you are one of the best examples of a living, breathing anachronism we've ever seen." If the brothers could see us now. Because here we are discussing what's wrong with black people and what's wrong with red people. Well, Marty didn't. I gotta give him the benefit of the doubt at this point, you know. what's wrong, you know, what's wrong with him? And we are by innuendo at this point trying to say what's right with white people. You may not be aware of that, but that's what's coming down to me right now. And it's, quite frankly, becoming nauseating. Sickening. Now, I know that you have to do that, I guess. I don't know. But if that's what you've got to do, then maybe I should leave the room and have you do that. And after you've done that, and you're ready to get at the real questions, and I still think that I raised some pretty important questions tonight, even about you and your Eucharist, and some other things, and so that we're faithful to, and I think we're getting to this, you know, we're faithful to at least creating some sort of understanding for rage and violence, whatever you want to call it,
you know, we ought to pursue this thing a little more. And I think that's where you were leading us. So.
In other words, the only time you notice me in this world of broken promises is when I do get violent. Then, of course, the sociologist today proved or used a beautiful example. I won't name the city, but he said in his city that they had been promised, well, during the heat of a, you know, a burning, they decided they'd cool them off, so they closed off some streets, opened some fire hydrants, and flooded it. Of course, that cooled things down, but they had been promised a swimming pool. The park district apparently passed a bond issue where they would build a pool, but 4 years later there's still no pool, you know, so where's this going? So what I have to do is get a little more violent. Hey, notice me. It's just like in your own families. A kid at home feels this undercutting, the sense of false promise, of really no future, no hope. So what does he do? He'll run away. Hey, look me over, you know? It's the same kind of thing, isn't it? And our history is just full of broken promises to the third world. And we're too impatient to fulfill any of the obligations. I mean, we think that here, now here's a pill, swallow it, and this will cure it. And we don't realize what this backlog of broken promises strewn throughout our history has done to the oppressed, regardless of color.
Now, one thing that bothers me about the promises that we haven't kept is the fact that we as Scandinavians act around. We've heard our friends and relatives say, well, I work for it, but we work like I did. And if we fail to remember that when our forefathers came over here, they were given a homestead. And that much of the business and railroads in this country were subsidized too.
You mean they were given it without working first?
They won't. Yes. They were given this opportunity. They had opportunity, and they were given this really. And we say we worked for it, you know, and let them work for it like we did. I don't think we're really altogether consistent then. When we say we have no debt, no promise here, you know, to give the black man the same opportunity that we had.
Why can't we just consider that the background sort of cancel each other out? The background of the greater opportunities that white is taking advantage of and used and holds up the Negro as an example of what he should follow, the Negro holding up the example of the oppression that he has felt and holding this up as an example, as a reason for why he should have why he actually has a debt that he should collect. Why can't we just consider that these cancel each other out and just take the problem from here, you know, a new wineskin and not first the old?
Well, you see, Bank of America won't let me do that. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's not a put-on. You know, the Bank of America says, you pay your debt. Well, I've been owing you for 25 years. Here are the circumstances. Why can't, you know, this debt be canceled out? And here is the thing with which it ought to be canceled out against. They say, no. No. The only thing that cancels this debt out is what you owe us.
Well, let me ask you.
Now, you see, now people talk about, I've heard people talk about how hard white folks have worked and how much they have had to give up in this land. Well, you see, there is a peculiar, and we cannot ignore history. I think that, you know, and we cannot cancel it out like that. You see, now Marty can say something about this later on because that's history, you see. But you see the peculiar the peculiar circumstances surrounding the arrival of the first black man in this land, on the good ship Jesus, by the way, sort of makes it impossible to say let's cancel it out. Black people were trapped like animals and brought to this land. And the things that happened to them are the things that did not happen to Mr. Thardy, who's a Hungarian, one of the most recent, one of y'all to come to this country, by choice, of course, who had a travel agency
in a hotel that I couldn't sleep in when I had been working and living in that town as a minister for 5 years. You see, Mr. Thardy finally, after he, because it was sort of inconvenient for him to always sneak my airplane tickets to me, you know, to, you know, because he didn't want the white people to know that there was a black man in town who needed a travel agent, you know, and that he was serving his needs, sort of rejoiced, you know, because he said, you should own the travel agency and you should be sneaking plane tickets and stuff to me, you see, because I came to this country and walked right into a multi-million-dollar business. Homesteads and things.
We all know the problems. What I want are some solutions.
Well, do you know the problem?
Yes, sir.
What is the problem?
It's
what color is it?
One of the problems is, the people from Detroit can tell you, that I asked my distributor, let's go to town and have dinner. And he said, you've got to be off your rocker. Nobody goes in Detroit downtown at night.
What is the problem and what color is it?
It's black and it's white and it don't mix unless there's love, right?
What is the problem and what color is it?
The problem is the Negroes are rioting. They have been oppressed and suppressed, and about 90% of the time I don't blame them. But let's take the man that bought the stock of bananas, and let's say let's give every Negro, every man that's even faintly colored, $40,000 cash. How long would that man have it?
You see, the very fact that you use with a great deal of proficiency that those words colored and Negro indicate to me that you've got a problem.
Yes, I do. I explained it when the first question I asked.
And that
and
is
we live in a practical world.
That is the problem, sir.
What, that we live in a practical world?
No, the fact that we are still colored and Negro, which is not our problem, because we know what color we are, and we know who we are, and we will be damned if we will allow you to define us any longer.
We tell us
color. All right, then from Negro. Now on, I will use whatever word you suggest.
You have to suggest it, that's it.
I think that the problem is not defined in one color. I think that the color is the color of paper that you read. It's history. Everything that we have today is a result of past history. And I think it will all be ironed out.
What color is that history?
The history is a history of all the people involved.
Is it?
Yes, it is.
Which school do you attend?
I attend Harvard School.
Harvard School where?
North Hollywood, California.
Great.
It's great, yes.
What color is Hollywood, California? What color is the school? What color are the teachers? What color is the history that you have read?
The history of not only the American people, but of the Hebrew people, and also a general history of the formation of the Western world, including the involvement of the blacks. The times when they were imported as slaves.
Do you mind if I embarrass you a little bit at this point?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know anything about Charles Drew?
No, sir.
Do you know anything about Toussaint Louverture?
No, sir.
Do you know anything about Crispus Attucks?
Attucks.
Do you know anything at all? Well, I think I've gone far enough.
Well, some of us do. So, Drew Scott Case, St. Louis.
Well, you see, well, some of us do don't quite cut it, friend. I can't let you get away with that.
Well, I mean, I went to a public school, and I was in public school before this whole business came up, and I learned, I mean, the Dred Scott case and the Toussaint Louverture and Haiti. You can pick it up, then. I don't think it was.
You see, well, why doesn't he just pick it up? Why doesn't he just pick it up?
Let's take a show of hands and see how many people know here.
He is living in what is, you know, the most diverse, the most colorful, the most talked about, the best known segment of this society, Hollywood.
Because he's only 15.
I'd give him the time if such a thing, a liberal arts education, and let him get to college. And
he is only, he is only 15 and a half past the cup by him. And don't let him drink. Pass the cup by him because he's only 15 and a half.
You don't have to worry about that. I mean, you're white.
But wait a minute. Some
you're white. You live in a white community.
We got
the and that's the problem.
All right then. What is the answer then? Someone in the black community speak up and say, this is the answer that will bring peace and harmony and brotherhood and repay the debt to the black people. Now, we do live in a practical world, and somewhere the check has to pass from one hand to another. And the black people have to be educated, know how to deal with that. Now,
do you have children? Do you have children?
How do we do that?
Listen to them. Do you have children? Hush up, child. Your elders are talking.
Who is that man?
I don't know, but he apparently has the answer. Tell us the answer. Son, I'm interested. I want to know.
Son?
That's right. Young man, son, however you want to call it. We're all brothers, aren't we?
I asked the same question about 2 years ago, and I got it thrown right back in my face and said, they said, she was very indignant because I asked the question. What can I do to help the black man? She says, it's not the black man's problem.
Right.
It's the white man's problem. And and she said, if you want to do something about the problem, go back to your own community and start telling people you're prejudiced.
Yeah.
Start loving each other. And, it seems to me where it begins is with your kids. I mean, they're going to grow up someday. And they're going to be in society. If they come out, with no color lines, at least, they don't see color. Well, I'll take that back. They see color, but it doesn't mean what it means now in our society. So, like this last year, I'm going to seminary now. And so I'm supposed to be involved in the community some way involved in the church. And of course, the big thing is get involved in the inner city, go down to the ghetto and help people. And I began to realize that that's not what I should do. That's not my bag. So I went out to a suburban community in Minneapolis, and I taught a confirmation class. That was what I felt I was doing to help the problem of racism.
Well, Al, don't you think that most people are willing to do something like that? I think probably most of
Yeah, but you see, that's we don't have that kind of a focus. It's just like Willie said that, the discussion was making him sick because we were talking about the black man's problem. Well, it's not the black man's problem.
I realize that. That's why I've been here, and that's why I've been going around listening.
Yeah. So I think it's like we have to start talking among ourselves. It's like Willie says. Maybe we need to stay. Maybe he needs to leave the room, and we sit here and talk about what we are.
No, but I can't do that because I want to know.
We're a suburb of the urban civilization. We all got TV sets.
five people in the town. But they organized the whole countryside, and every farmer and family took in one black child from the Minneapolis ghetto for summers. So you'd have them living in the streets, see them in their home, have them in their church, eat with them at their table, have have it right in their midst, and join this human race at this moment. It was a tremendous thing for them. These kids came up the summer after here, and they were human beings. They were open to our society. They were realizing after they forget this concrete event, something of what love means. I mean, this is one thing they could do, and they did it.
I think that points out a difference when we were talking about the adults want to say, well, what can we do? What can we give you? But, and, you know, that's going to solve the problem, but it's what we can do for each other, interpersonal. Not, there's no price tag, you know, money or any job. We have to learn to feel, you know, the interpersonal bit.
But the five families in North Dakota is not 250,000 people in Dallas, which is just a small segment of a solid South, which is nothing compared to segregation in Chicago and New York and Detroit.
North Dakota's problem is not black, it is red.
Maybe the thing is, you know, you don't go back to your white communities and teach them you're prejudiced. You go back and you teach them how to be human.
All right.
Because even when you came in here, you made a remark, and that's when I fell off the balcony. That Jesus Christ had calluses on his hands, even though he had long hair.
That's right.
You can't even be human, you know, like you said, you want a white young nigger.
I don't believe I said that. I don't believe I've ever said that. My friend, I've been called a nigger more time than this man has.
Let's count that.
By 42 classmates for about 8 years. That was my name. I didn't even know what it meant till I got back to this country.
Well, I'm afraid, sir, that in many ways I really admire you come on real strong in your situation. The problem is, I think that you see that you're going to get burned because I think we're all going to get burned, frankly, and I think we don't like it.
What color does burning make one? Is it?
It hurts, and I think, you know, we're kind of beginning to be drawn into the conflict for the first time. Maybe it's, some people are saying, you know, now the college kids are getting clubbed, we know what the police brutality the black man has been facing all along. Well, history is moving us to the conflict, and we're beginning to get involved. And now we're looking around for something that's going to say, how can we fix up the situation? You know, what can we do? Give us a concrete way that we're going to solve this problem. We can't. This country is so solidly racist that it is ridiculous. And you and I are products of this society, and subconsciously we have parts of this within us, so that we even sit here and talk about Will as black and colored. You know, this is our categories of thought. This is the environment in which we grow up. This is our whole country. And what, frankly, I don't know what we can do about it, except I don't know what to do, because I'm not very hopeful. But you can work out in small ways, but I think you have to start with the assumption that it's a white problem, that the white people are the ones who have made the stew. We have been the ones who brought the blacks over, set the tone, and they have been reacting to our culture. What we're going to do with me, I don't know.
I have been spending an awful lot of time in study. I'm trying to call it all that good. We always seem to come back to that. And I think what you said before about the human interest is what Professor Parkinson said this morning, and that's the first thing, one of the most important things I've heard this week, is to admit that we are racist.
Let's understand why.
We have racist tendencies. Wait a minute. And we have all gathered at Golden Village because deep down in we feel a need for this kind of community. And we are seeking to become more whole than when we came here. whites or even blurs. Would you say that that's pretty much in general what we'd like to take with us?
Would you agree to bringing a little darkness?
Sure, yeah. That would be an interpretation of the same meaning. I mean, a word meaning exactly the same thing.
Yeah, it's just that, you know, the hymn Dark and Light are both alike to thee is sort of difficult to deal with in this setting, isn't it?
Well, I'm sorry.
Right.
No,
well, do your own thing.
All right, well, is that what we're going to try to achieve when we go back to our home?
It seems to me that part of the gospel, while it is certainly comforting, is also at the same time also offensive. And we can't, you know, maybe we have to bring disturbance back with us too, as well as comfort. And it seems to me if this is a white problem, that's what we have to bring.
Well, I don't mean taking just peace and sweet, nothing. No, we'll take the disturbance back with us, because we all care very much. All right, now, what can we do to help in our, what can we do? And the outside, sure. All right, I'm a mature individual. I have children. I you know, do the best I can. Sure, I'm racist, but I do the best I can. And I care very much that any other mother could achieve things for her children. I'd like to help. Now, what can I do?
I remember once saying in a sermon, and it was after I'd had my driver's license, my credentials and everything else checked to get into Berkeley, because it was a garrison, it was and still is, as is this country, a garrison state. It was over the People's Park question. And it was Pentecost, 1969. And the mayor of the town was in church that Sunday to read a statement along with several council of churches people, and a lot of dignitaries were there, and I had to preach. Well, first of all, I had to explain why I was preaching in a Methodist church on Pentecost to some Lutherans, which the explanation was not satisfactory, by the way. And I just made a simple statement which said something to this effect: being possessed by the Spirit could get a man killed. Recognizing also, and I agree with your understanding of the gospel, sir, except that, as I said earlier this week, you know, this, I think, illustrates what you're saying, is that the gospel only does two things at this hour. It either converts or it drives people mad. And that's what the gospel is. It's going to do one or the other. And one who wishes to present the gospel takes his chances, I would suppose, with those who are going to go mad. Now, to say what can I do, you know, frustrates me, because I don't know you personally. I don't know where you live, what church you belong to, how many children you've got, what your occupation is, or any of those things. Well, collectively, I know that you're white folks, and I know that you're racist. I know that there are some things that you can do, but I think it's at this point that it becomes a highly individual thing. You see, the whole point is that I must say at this point, use your head. Use your head.
Thank you.
Use your heart, because that's why God gave them to you, and that's why he went through all the trouble to die.
Professor, can I comment on something to do? I've had the occasion to be involved in something to do to help the Indian and the blacks, and it involves a federal housing authority program, which, contrary to this lady's remarks, was appropriated by Congress and fully funded by Congress. I got involved in it, and now I'm starting to wonder, I never thought I was a racist, but maybe I am because of my reaction to the program as such. The program consisted of setting up a corporation to take advantage of the program. The program was to buy old houses that were run down, beat up, and uninhabitable for the most part, to fix them up with our own money and to sell them to the low-income groups, and that happened to be mostly blacks and Indians. We, as in the corporation, the decision makers were blacks and Indians. The other group, the coordinators, the expertise, was supplied by whites, as it turned out. I find in working that we can't seem to get any decisions out of decision makers. And I'm starting to wonder, is it a fact that maybe I impose myself upon them too much to try and get decisions, and thereby get them mad at me? Am I a racist in thinking that they can't make decisions, or is it the fact that they have been brought up in an environment where they've never had to make a decision? And I'm disillusioned with the program. I'm disillusioned with what I'm trying to do. I'm wondering if I'm in it the wrong way, if I'm thinking the wrong way about it, or if I should just drop it all. We can't get those who are supposed to be helped with the program to work in it and to make the decision which we feel they ought to make the program operate effectively. Now, I sit there and say, what am I doing here? Maybe I'm all wrong in trying to think that I can help in this way. Am I a racist?
Yes.
Are you a racist? I thought of myself as one, and when I got involved in that program, I started to think maybe I am one. But here I'm trying to help them. I've never thought of, I've never tried to impose my will. I've just tried to offer the suggestions where I thought they needed it. And yet, to seem to get the thing going, you've got to try and make a decision.
You see, the problem is that whenever you use words, the way I thought they needed it, that's one of the very live giveaways with us. Mm-hmm. You know, what right have you to think what they need? You know,
The need is a better home.
You're talking about givens, a better home. And that's true. I think that blacks and poor have said that they need those. Except that, when a program as the one you are involved in comes on, it comes on with, yes, we recognize that you need them, we will get them for you, but on our terms. You will get them the way we think you ought to get them, mm-hmm. and you will not get them any other way.
Well, this was the purpose of course.
And I think that may be one of the sources of your frustration at this point.
Well, maybe then what you're saying is that if there is a decision here, I should sit back and wait for the drift and write down.
Well, I'm not saying that. No.
I just wonder if you could help us. I think the language, is terribly important. You're so right that racism can easily be understood by this kind of words. And I was wondering about this very practical question, which seems to me we're all hung up on. If we are going to have federal programs, and we do need federal monies, and that's not incompatible with this government compensation fund for all the years of loss. Now, what I'm trying to figure out is what kind of program from federal government in the field of housing, I'm sure you've thought about this a lot. I'm wishing you our heads, I know, but what about your head?
President, what's his name? I'm becoming terribly sensitive to Marty's inability to call certain names.
Is that the president that followed 30 years of Democratic administration?
Let's
get to the question.
All right, okay. Little levity never hurt anybody, I remember when the Lutheran Witness Reporter did an account of Dr. King's funeral. Those of us who read the Lutheran Witness Reporter remember that. They said it was really like a circus, because people would go in and they would stare at Brother Martin's body and they would come out laughing, laughing and talking, and And one guy said, you know, this wasn't a Lutheran witness reporter, but it was a conversation that we heard on the street. You know, it wasn't nervous laughter either. You know, those people were, you know, it's really genuine laughter. So, you know, I have to understand laughter, you know, and you also have to understand the humor of black folks. It may be one of the white man's saviors yet. Anyway, he came on with, you know, we have got the answer. We're not going to accept the guaranteed annual wage. You know, we're not going to do that. We're not going to go with the old ADC program either. You know, whatever it is. Yeah. We're going to get something that's in between, that's better. And I don't know what he calls it, you know, but it's terrible. You see, it really terrible. And so I watched CBS, and they only had one black person reacting to it. They had Finch and several other people reacting to the speech. And the black man said, I'm willing to bet all of you people here that, you know, in less than 2 years, we will be talking about the guaranteed annual wage again. Because there are no shades of gray, you know, in determining what should happen in this particular instance. And of course, Finch had already said, and because Finch said it, it was accepted, you know, that black people are not shiftless and lazy and stuff like this. They had checked them out, had taken samplings of ADC mothers and stuff, and they do want to work, you know. So it was all right now, finally Finch had discovered this. Of course, historians know that that's like Columbus discovering the Indians or Michael Harrington discovering what poverty is all about, too. You know, so this great discovery, you know, of a program which would eliminate the problem is again racist, because it has not really, you know, listened to and accepted the self-definition of people. You see, what we really need at this point now is something other than that sort of thing. So I'm not really able at this point to suggest concrete, well-defined programs that are going to eliminate those needs. I have got some questions, you know, and I've been raising those questions all week, you know. But I'm not, you know, I trust the man's ingenuity. You know, I really do. He has got intellectual and thinking prowess that's out of sight. Out of sight. As far as you can see. 2 years, Mars. 2 years, and even beyond that. And for him to ask a simple black clergyman to come up with a program that's going to work is hard, because the black fella knows that he is getting snowed. You know, he's being asked to tell the white man to do something so that the white man can convince him beyond a shadow of a doubt that he can't do it. I think I remember what I said. Suggestions 2 and 4 black people. Just don't offer me suggestions. Go and do it. Say you're going to do it, and don't just say you're going to do it. Do it, because you can. That's all.
It's like this. I don't think the question is asking Will, what can I do?
Right.
It's not. That's not even it. And it's not asking these people next to you, because I don't know where you're living, but where I'm from, people have been telling me, and they've been trying, and they've been screaming for a long time. And where my hang-up is how do I get started? And it's right inside of me. And where do I go? It's not asking someone. It would be so foolish for me to ask, well, what can I do? Because I've had people tell me what I can do. And there are people out doing things, and I see them doing things. We had one of the activists. Yeah, but that's what he's talking about. And we've had activists on campus who well, what? Go ahead and say what your.
That question was a long time ago. Just now, a man over that way asked him to sell him a plant.
Let's ask this gentleman if he's satisfied.
He said he couldn't do it because he doesn't have the know-how, and he doesn't have the capacity, he doesn't have the know-how. But then he went on to say that even if I gave you a plan to shut it down, and he, a moment earlier, said that the black man doesn't want the white man to tell him, and yet he turned around and said that when he was asked, then he turned around and said, if I tell you, you can shoot it down. So how do we resolve such an impossible, such an impact?
Well, I don't blame. The white people have done nothing to make the black people trust us. Why should Will trust us? Our whole history up and out has been one that he couldn't trust us. We've got to start doing very little simple things that ordinary people do. I don't hire anybody, and I don't deal in federal housing, and I'm just an ordinary, simple little mother and then church worker. And all I can do is teach my kids, when they hear the kid on the playground calling somebody a nigger, to do something about it. We have so few black people in Vancouver, it's difficult to have the opportunity for face-to-face. Why not find other ways to look?
Peggy, there's another way. Choose Peggy. I've thought about this. Should we always have a man who knew what can I do?
You know, it's like...
And it hit me tonight when John was talking up there. This summer, a woman, she was very confident and a good friend came, but she's also the one that's been the children's hospital and he's president, and if I wanted to go socially, this is the one that I should be. You know, but right. And she came up and you can't help but talk to me. It's a thin of people. And everybody keeps pressing me to buy it from black problem. I don't care where you live or anything about it.
It's a white problem.
It's like in a movie.
Good. Hey, she's my mother.
You see, one of the beauties, right? Are you finished? Because if he wants you to talk, you're gonna talk. That's why you gotta talk. You know, I live by examples, and here's another example. I hate to give them, when I haven't checked with people about them first, especially if they're in the room. You know, it's like I sneak my thing in about Marty. You know, when he, the Martys, whenever they're away. Have y'all noticed that? You know, I'll sneak in little stuff. You know, because but there's a doctor in the camp, a white doctor. You know. I don't know for what reason he came, other than, to unwind. Now, Kathy went running on a hike, and she got a sliver under her finger. And I think my wife and the nurse in the hospital, worked frantically to get that sliver out but Kathy wasn't cooperating, and the sliver wasn't either. And so they didn't ask what can we do. They went and got a doctor, you know, the two of them, and they got this doctor, and this doctor didn't ask what can I do, you know. Neither did this doctor give me a lecture on how to prevent little children from getting slivers under their fingernails. You know, the doctor was a bit, you know, as doctors are, you know, because, you know, there's all sorts of laws and things, and I, you know, and first of all, he had to say, I am a doctor, you know, and he had to give me his credentials, because, you see, if gangrene or if poison or something sets in, you know, he could be sued, right? You know, so, but anyway, here is a sliver under the fingernail, and there is no rhetoric. No rhetoric. Just action. Well, there was rhetoric. Kathy. And the nurse said, "Don't shut her up. You let her go. You know, don't even dry her tears." But see, there was that action, and as the young folks have taught me to say, and it said, you know, very simply, but it means so much. And it was beautiful. It was so beautiful.
Wasn't that action based on knowledge that he gained through study? And he knew what to do through those things, and he sent you and lived your life. Okay, we're to listen to the problem, but we don't know what it is.
A couple of people have commented tonight, you know, like, we don't know what the problem is, we're not around the problem. When Ray Christensen, a gentleman who was in the movie A Time for Burning, took this movie to a small town in Iowa and showed it to a Lutheran congregation, after the movie was over, the next day he went and listened to the sermon. The pastor said, you know, I was up all night changing my sermon around. This movie moved me so much. And he proceeded to tell how he was thanked the good Lord that they lived in this small town that didn't have any problems like the big city. And this is what I hear, and a lot of people hear, you know, like, we don't live near it. We can't do anything about it because we're not around it. We don't know what it is.
Folks, I you know, I must go now, because, you know, there's a part of my anatomy which does more than suggest to me that I've worked hard all day, and I've caught some big fish, and I'm going to sit down with a couple of people and eat them. You know, I if I were Jesus at this point, I'd do what was necessary. but since I can't, that's one of the givens. You know, I must do what I must do, and I must go and eat my fish now. Confident that there is a tomorrow. Carol always takes it in, and he somehow devotes, you know. And there are mornings and evenings and afternoons and what have you. But with me, it's always morning, right? So now I'm going to go and have my breakfast and then retire to a little unlaxing. I'll be back whenever the schedule says so, or whenever you want me back.
I'd like to say something. whether you are here, sir, or not, I just have something I want to say to the group.
Well, that's just perfectly all right. I'm excusing myself, all right?
This is about things that we can do on beyond more of an individual basis, you know, raising our kids and talking with the neighbors, because black people are telling us, giving us suggestions. They are talking to us. And I keep hearing, first of all, police brutality as their number one complaint. And yet, we are not doing anything but giving them more police brutality. I saw a film on the Black Panthers and how they had listed out, they have 10 demands in which black people are giving us suggestions. And police brutality is at the top of the list. And we keep thinking, you know, how much we do not spend in this area, in our, in state and local levels. We do not spend money for police unless we're forced. But yet, we could spend so much more to improve our police forces in positive ways. And just, you say we don't have the money to spend in this way. This is what the usual bite is. But since we've had riots in Watts and in Oakland and these things, the expenditures has gone up much more. I think the police in Watts has gone from, say, 350 up to 3,000 or something like this of additional money poured into the area in terms of police action, but it's all been negative. We haven't been listening to the response. We've just been building up riots, squads, more material. We've been spending the money in police action, but it's been not the kind that the black people are saying they want and they need. And consequently, the violence is rising. Police brutality is one of the main social things, I think.
Could I comment on that a little bit?